ओ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। पुंसो वर्षशतं ह्यायुस् तद्धर्धां चजितात्मनः निष्फलं यदसौ रात्रं शेतेन्द्रं प्रपितस्तमः। Mother, Pungsaha, of every human being. Varsha Shatam, 100 years, he, indeed, Ayu, duration of life, Tat, of that, Adardham, half, Cha, and Ajita Atmanaha, of a person who was a servant of his senses, Nishpalam, without profit, without meaning, yet, because asau, that person, ratram, at night, shete, sleeps, andham, ignorance, forgetting his body and soul, prapitaha, being completely possessed of, tamaha, darkness, translation in poor part by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation, every human being has a maximum duration of life of 100 years, but from one who cannot control his senses, half of those years are completely lost because at night he sleeps 12 hours, being covered by ignorance. Therefore, such a person has a lifetime of only 50 years. Purport, Lord Brahma, a human being and an ant all live for 100 years. But their lifetimes of 100 years are different from one another. This world is a relative world, and its relative moments of time are different. Thus, the 100 years of Brahma are not the same as the 100 years of a human being. From Bhagavad Gita, we understand that Brahma's daytime of 12 hours equals 4,300,000 times 1,000 years. Sahasra yugam paryantam ahar yat brahmano vidu. Thus, the Varsha Shatam, or 100 years, are relatively different according to time, person, and circumstances. As far as human beings are concerned, the calculation given here is right for the general public. Although one has a maximum of 100 years of life, by sleeping, one loses 50 years. Eating, sleeping, sex life, and fear are the four bodily necessities. But to utilize the full duration of life, a person desiring to advance in spiritual consciousness must reduce these activities. That will give him an opportunity to fully use his lifetime. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. So Prahlada Maharaj is advocating the application of Bhagavad Dharma, devotion, from the very beginning of life, from the beginning of starting at 5 years of age. And so he, in order to make that point more compelling, he wanted to present a contrast to a life devoid of Bhagavad Dharma or a life devoid of bhakti. So the previous verses, we heard him starting to present arguments which basically state that without a life of bhakti, one is more or less wasting his time. And then he wants to reinforce that argument, make it even more compelling. So in the next series of verses, he's just presenting a case of how one wastes one's life. So that's the next set of verses. In fact, Prabhupada, I think, gives a lecture on these series of verses called How to Waste Your Life. I remember seeing that and thinking, I don't need any help. It's not too difficult. Because wasting one's life is an inherent trait of conditioned life. But anyway, Prahlada Maharaj is describing this here to make his point more compelling, beginning with this verse. So here it says that the person, Pumsaha, Purusha, or Pumsa refers to the living entities in various bodies, particularly to the human being, because that's what Prahlada Maharaj is talking about. Varsha Shatam, that they live for 100 years. So most of Prabhupada's purport is about this word, Varsha Shatam, saying how all living entities live for 100 years, but time is relative, so it impacts relatively. So we live for 100 years, and a mosquito or a fly may also live for 100 years, but their 100 years may be passed up in a day, for us, our day, whereas our 100 years seems longer, and Lord Brahma's 100 years seems longer. But experientially, it's just the same 100 years. That is most of Prabhupada's purport. So everyone is living 100 years, but I use tadhardham. That lifespan is cut in half. Ajitatmana nishpala. It is cut in half due to uncontrolled senses, in which one is engaged without profit or without meaning. The word nishpala means without profit or without meaning. So half of one's life is cut down due to the uncontrolled senses, which engages one in activities which are without profit or without meaning. Prahlada Maharaj has already presented activities in the daytime in the previous verses. So in this verse, he particularly says, Yadhaso ratram shetendham prapitastamaha. Those uncontrolled senses engage one in sleep, sleeping a lot, 12 hours a day. So in this way, although you have a lifetime of 100 years, 50 of those years is cut down due to sleep, which is due to the uncontrolled senses. So Prabhupada also just makes an extra point in the purport, saying that eating, sleeping, sex life, and fear are the four bodily necessities. Yay! But to utilize the full duration of life, a person desiring to advance in spiritual consciousness must reduce these activities. That will give him an opportunity to fully utilize or use his lifetime. So the idea is that the uncontrolled senses, ajitatmanaha, engage one constantly in eating, sleeping, sex life, and bhayam, fearing, or the defense is how it's usually translated, the struggle for existence, paying bills, fighting for rights of all sorts, reparations, equal rights, marriage equality, these sorts of things. The senses engage one in such activities. In this way, one's life is spoiled. So if one wants to advance in spiritual consciousness, these things have to be reduced, which basically is to indicate that one has to control his senses and engage his senses according to a higher objective, a higher ideal. That will give him an opportunity to fully utilize his lifetime. Any questions about this? So it's a very simple verse, yeah. We have a microphone. Yeah, I'll repeat the question. Yeah, in Bhagavatam 1.2.10, it talks about self-preservation.
And the importance of keeping body and soul together, but not endeavoring for self-gratification, sense gratification. And so Srila Prabhupada makes the comment that devotees... he makes the point that those who are seeking after the absolute truth they become overwhelmed by that endeavor, and they do not have time for engaging in the eating, mating, sleeping, and defending. Yeah. So what does he mean by becoming overwhelmed by the search for the absolute truth?
There's this verse from the Bhagavatam Chatur Shloki, Etava Tatva Jignasam Tatva Jignasunatmanaha. This verse says that the serious student of the absolute truth must certainly inquire up until this point. Up until what point? Up until the point of prema. This is a verse that speaks of the sarana, which is to realize the rahasyam. Rahasya refers to prema. Because Krishna tells Lord Brahma in that section that he will speak of four topics. Gana, vigana, rahasyam, and tadanga. So the rahasyam refers to prema. And tadanga refers to that which is an aspect of the prema, which is the sadhana that leads to prema. So in describing that, Krishna says, one must certainly search up the serious student, tatva jignasuna, which is a similar statement in 1.2.10, which is tatva jignasa, right? So the serious investigator of the absolute truth, a spiritual Sherlock Holmes, if you will, must certainly search up, inquire up until this point. Up until what point? To the point of prema. So what does it mean to be overwhelmed by the research work of the truth? My, let's say, feeling for the verses or that statement is that his feeling for absolute beatitude is comprehensive, meaning that it's conquered his senses, it's conquered his mind, his, her mind, intellect. And so that they're overwhelmed, I need prema, I need prema, I need prema. The goal of life, in other words, the objective of my existence. After having heard that from Guru, then one comes to think, this is my real necessity. So just like when you're hungry, like on Jamastami, when we're hungry, what is your necessity? More than food, you just want something to drink usually, especially when it's hot. So many times during the Jamastami festival, you'll see many of us when we're on the stage here, we'll go upstairs and get like a nectar drink or some water, but usually a nectar drink because it's cold and refreshing. It's sweet, tastes good. And we'll put it on top of the speaker, you know, like 5 minutes before the conch blows. And then while the conch is blowing, then we're also... So we have some energy for the kirtan, you know. So when our necessity is something to drink that time, we're thirsty. So that probably conquers our whole, our mind, our intellect. We can't think of anything. Our senses don't desire anything else. Our mind is not able to contemplate other things. Just something to drink. So in the same way, being overwhelmed with the research work of the truth, tatva jignasunatmana, means that the search for our highest objective, our highest ideal, is conquering our intellect, our mind, our senses. So you can't think of other things. Therefore, there is no time for sense gratification. That's my feeling for that particular statement of Srila Prabhupada's, like this. Any other questions about this verse? We can move on. All right, we'll continue the tale of how to waste our life. Mugdhasya bhale kaishore kritato yati vimshiti daraya grasta dehasya yatya kalpasya vimshiti. In the tender age of childhood, when everyone is bewildered, Mugdhasya bhale. One passes 10 years, similarly, in boyhood engaged in sporting and playing, one passes another 10 years, so that's 20. In this way, 20 years are wasted. Similarly, in old age, when one is an invalid, unable to perform even material activities, one passes another 20 years wastefully. So that looks like 90 years to me, but Prabhupada says 70 in the purport. Anyway, purport, without Krishna consciousness, one wastes 20 years in childhood and boyhood, and another 20 years in old age, when one cannot perform any material activities and is full of anxiety about what is to be done by his sons and grandsons and how one's estate should be protected. This is the torture of old age. Or they're just kind of worse than death. Because in old age, you have plenty of time due to being an invalid and incapacitated to regret and to think about how all your family members are jacking everything up. So it's a type of suffering. Prabhupada is mentioning this here. Half of these years are spent in sleep. Furthermore, one wastes another 30 years sleeping at night during the rest of his life. Thus, 70 out of 100 years are wasted by a person who does not know the aim of life and how to utilize his human form. Anyway, so 70 years we got here. Any questions about this? Okay. The tale of how to waste one's life continues. Dura purena kamena mohena chabaliyasa sheisham griheshu saktasya pramatasya payatihi. One whose minds and senses are uncontrolled becomes increasingly attached to family life because of insatiable lusty desires and very strong illusion. In such a madman's life, the remaining years are also wasted because even during those years, he cannot engage himself in devotional service. So the Sanskrit dura purena kamena means, kamena means strong desires for enjoyment. You want to enjoy, isn't it? Enjoyment. Dura purena, which is never fulfilled. One has desires for material enjoyment, isn't it? You have desires for material enjoyment? Have you ever tried satisfying your senses before? Have you felt satisfied by that? Dura purena. So that is mentioned here. Strong desires to enjoy. Even you enjoy, it is never fulfilled, isn't it? Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, dushpare na analena cha, that these desires are like a fire that burns. Actually, someone give me Bhagavad Gita. I don't remember the Sanskrit. How does it start, this verse? Krishna describes the cruelty of lusty desires, kama. How does he describe it? He says, first thing it does is cover one's knowledge. You know this verse? Anyone know any verses from Bhagavad Gita? Huh? I can't hear you. Yes, this one. This one. Avritam gana etena. Ganina nitaverina. So avritam gana etena. So how does kama affect? Kama was described as a great devourer. What does he devour? A great eater. Mahashana. Mahashana means a great eater. So what does the kama eat? Everything. Your mind, your senses, your intellect. So it's describing here this great eater. Avritam gana etena. So he covers one's knowledge of the self different from matter. And therefore, as such, he is described as the nitya verina kamarupena. He's described as the eternal enemy of the soul. And Prabhupada says in the purport, very interesting, what is the eternal enemy of the soul? Okay, lust. So that's the easy answer. But Prabhupada gives a nice insight in the purport. The eternal enemy is that feeling or that thought that says, this feels good. That's the eternal enemy of the soul. When you're doing something, you think to yourself, this feels good. That feeling is the eternal enemy of the soul. Prabhupada says that. Let me see if I can find it here. I always thought that was fascinating when I read that. While one enjoys sense gratification, it may be that there is some feeling of happiness. But actually, that so-called feeling of happiness is the ultimate enemy of the sense enjoyer. So that feeling, this feels good. That is the eternal enemy. So nitya verina kamarupena, the eternal enemy in the form of lust. What is the eternal enemy? It's very difficult to hear. This feels good. This feels good. That is just like sometimes you're supposed to be hearing the class, but sitting up straight doesn't feel good. So you go horizontal. In my room, that happens all the time. Devotees just go horizontal. And what happens? This feels good. And then after that, you go to sleep shortly thereafter. Like yesterday, Marky, he slept real good during the class. Even when we woke him up, he was like... So this is the eternal enemy. This feels good. Whenever you get that feeling, you might be in danger water. dangerous waters. So it covers the knowledge of the soul, and it generates a burning sensation. Dushprerna, same word mean here used also, durapurena. Dushprerna on the lanacha. It is just like a fire which is burning you to gratify, but it is never satisfied. So such is the cruel nature of lust. It covers your knowledge that you cannot get any happiness from your engagement with the world of sense objects on the one hand. At the same time, it gives you this burning sensation that tells you that you can gratify and be happy by doing so. And then in your attempts to do so, you are never satisfied. So durapurena kamina, this is mentioned here. Strong desires which are never satisfied. Then mohena, one is completely bewildered. Chabaliyasa, by strong illusion. I am this body, these things are mine, these things will make me happy. So on account of this kama and this great formidable bewilderment or delusion, what happens? Shesham griheshu saktasya. The remaining years of life are spent attached to family. Yesterday you were asking, Mitch, what is our view on family life? Here it is. It's coming up in great detail. It's not exactly very positive, but perhaps realistic. Shesham griheshu saktasya. It says there that the rest of the time you have left, already, Prabhupada said, previous purport, 70 years was gone, wasted, and childhood and invalidity and sleep. Now, whatever little time you have left, it is spoiled. How is it spoiled? Through the great desires which are never satisfied and very strong delusion, you'll spoil the remainder years of your life, shesham. How? By being attached to family. Bhagavatam concession. And this way you are, as like a mad person, you wastefully pass the rest of your years. Pramatasya, just like a mad person. Purport by Srila Prabhupada, this is the account of 100 years of life. Although in this age, a lifetime of 100 years is generally not possible, even if one has 100 years, the calculation is that 50 years are wasted in sleeping, 20 years in childhood and boyhood, and 20 years in invalidity, jaravyadi. This leaves only a few more years, like 10, right? But because of too much attachment to household life, those years are also spent with no purpose without God consciousness. Therefore, one should be trained to be a perfect brahmachari in the beginning of life, and then to be perfect in sense control, following the regulative principles, if one becomes a householder. From household life, one is ordered to accept vanaprastha life and go to the forest, and then accept sannyasa. That is the perfection of life. From the very beginning of life, those who are ajitendriya, who cannot control their senses, are educated only for sense gratification, as we have seen in the Western countries. Thus, the entire duration of a life of even 100 years is wasted and misused. And at the time of death, one transmigrates to another body, which may not be human. At the end of 100 years, one who has not acted as a human being in a life of tapasya, austerity, and penance, must certainly be embodied again in a body like those of cats, dogs, and hogs. Therefore, this life of lusty desires and sense gratification is extremely risky. So the inherent nature of the conditioned soul is to go for sense enjoyment by karma. That's basically what we heard. So materialistic life always pushes one towards householder life, actually. Mundane householder life. Therefore, you see that across the planet Earth, everyone is doing householder life, householder existence. So that is the nature of conditioned life. It pushes you towards household life. And the household, again, is the image of the defeat of the human mission, as I often recall this statement from the Bhagavatam. It is the image, like I said, we can make a little poster, the defeat of the human mission. Just put a really beautiful house. that you enter the house is compared to falling into a blind well in which no one ever hears you and you die. Just like if you fall into a blind well, like we were, when we, on the our little hiking thing, we went to this, it was like some really tall grass. And someone said, what if there's a blind well out there? So then we're like, well, we're not going to go investigate. Isn't it? If you know some field is there and you hear that there might be a blind well, then you don't even go near it because you don't know where it's at. You'll say, let me see. Maybe I can remove the covering so no one falls in. And then your attempt to investigate, and then you break your legs at the bottom of the well, and then you start screaming. But by the time the vibration gets to the top of the well, it phases out, you know, and no one hears you. And then you die after 4 days or so, 4 or 5 days, you die. Finished. So similarly, householder life is generally considered like this. When you are ajitendriya, when your senses are uncontrolled, then it pushes you towards household life. And the household is actually the image of enjoyment because you think, I have my privacy, or I can do what I want. I have facility. It's an image of enjoyment like this. So if one is not trained from the very beginning, so the idea Prabhupada is expressing in the purport is that this is a natural movement of conditioned life. So if one is not trained in the beginning how to control one's senses, then one's lot is to enter into the householder life as a sense enjoyer and become defeated by the house and the things accompanying the house, such as one's spouse and children and so on, responsibilities ad infinitum. So in the very beginning, one should get training in brahmacharya life. It is sad that even nowadays in our community of devotees, our devotee youth, they're not encouraged for any sort of brahmacharya training whatsoever. Not necessarily that they have to go to a brahmacharya ashram per se to get training in brahmacharya, but neither their parents are training them in brahmacharya, neither they encourage their children to take up brahmacharya life. So from the very beginning of 5 years, of course they may do things like bring the children to the temple and so on. But they do other things also, like allow the children to watch television, play with all sorts of toys. I mean, I wasn't trained as a devotee, but we were hardly allowed to play with toys. Our mom, her favorite expression was no. So we asked for many things. We would go, she would take us to toys, can't believe this. She would take us to Toys R Us sometimes and not buy us a single toy. I wouldn't know why are we in Toys R Us? You ain't gonna get us even one toy. I would ask her for the X-Men toy and this toy, Power Rangers toy. And the answer was no to everything. No, 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 no. This was training. I got so accustomed to hearing the word no that then you become like desireless. Because you knew the answer was going to anyway be no, so then you gave up the desire for the thing also. This is training. I'm not saying exactly it has to be like that, but it did help a lot, actually. So then when I was in high school and so on, I didn't have as many hankerings as such for those things because I knew the answer would anyway be no. I couldn't get the facility for it. So from the very beginning, one has to be trained up in this way, trained up and to discriminate a life of futility versus a life where one is progressively pursuing one's ideals. So one can pursue the ideal of Krishna consciousness even within householder life as part of the progression from brahmacharya to sannyas. Prabhupada is mentioning this here. But then that requires a lot of training in the brahmacharya stage. So throughout all these purports, Prabhupada has been advocating a lot for brahmacharya. Brahmacharya means that stage of life where education is imparted. So it doesn't just mean wearing saffron or living in the ashram. It means that stage of life where education is imparted. The education of how to control one's senses, what is the goal of life, how does one pursue that goal of life, the type of education that teaches about the different stages of life and what are the duties in each different stage of life by which one can progressively move towards the highest ideal. That stage of life is required. If one has not acted like a human being in a life of tapasya. So this verse is there. What is that? Neham de odeya bhajamna loke. Kashtan kaman arhite vidbujamye. Tapo divyam putra kanyena satam. Indicating this verse here. That the human form of life is not meant for enjoying the senses like the hogs and dogs who eat stool. In other words, you get enjoyment by eating lasagna, pizza, or vegan lasagna, vegan pizza, whatever, apples and peanut butter. We all have our different senses which find different sense objects enjoyable. But that is available to all creatures of life. So also the hogs, they don't get enjoyment by eating lasagna. They get enjoyment by eating stool. And the more organic and fresh, the better. You can see that in Vrindavan. When kids are passing, the hogs will just run up right after. Yeah, you see sometimes in Vrindavan. That is their particular, that's their cup of tea, their cup of sense enjoyment. So according to a mental concoction, everyone has a standard of sense enjoyment. And that's available to everyone, all species of life. You may say, well, they're not enjoying very nicely. But the hog will be looking at you, he is not enjoying very nicely. We are really enjoying very nicely. Or the monkey, I always joke that the monkey, he may feel bad for deprived humanity. Look how they have to go through all these antics just to get sex life. You know, dress up nicely, fixing their hair, you know, putting fragrance on. Then you need money, going out, taking to a restaurant. And then you have to come home, put on mood music. Human form of life is so, the monkey will be saying that like, this poor fellow, by the time he gets one time to enjoy sex, I would have already done it 25 times. He just simply goes up and rapes, practically. That is the program. He doesn't have to go through all this trouble to get his sense gratification. And after that, he sleeps for a good amount of time. But then after you do so, then you have to go to work. Sometimes they spend all night enjoying. Then right after that, you have to go straight to work. No sleep. So that's just dumb. So human form of life not meant for that. It's meant for divine austerity. Tapo divyam putra kanyena sattvam. If one does, divine austerity means, austerity means voluntarily accepting suffering for some higher purpose. So controlling one's senses is definitely a type of suffering. Now, on one level, on a mental, on a psychological level, to control one's senses is definitely a type of suffering. Just like when you're sick and you're told you're not supposed to eat certain eatables, but you have desire for those eatables. Do you not suffer when you control your senses? You suffer like anything. So sense control, a life of sense control for a higher ideal is certainly a type of tapasya, it's a type of suffering. But accept it for a higher purpose. Otherwise, you become cat and dog. And your mentality, and then after this life, you get cat and dog buddy. So Prabhupada is mentioning these things, these points here. Any questions, conversation about this verse? I don't know how far I want to go. It's 8 o'clock now. We've covered a few verses. Yeah. This is kind of...
For the sake of all the householders in the audience and that might be watching online.
For the householders who might be watching online.
What is the proper, because you made some very, very strong statements against it. So what is the, I mean, Srila Prabhupada went through Grihastha Ashram, Bhaktivinoda Thakura was a Grihastha. So what is the proper way, the ideal, because realistically most people are going to enter that ashram.
Well, the ideal way of entering Grihastha Ashram is to be first trained as a brahmachari. So that's what I was mentioning here. That's the ideal way. Some people have come to Krishna consciousness after having after having entered the household life. So there is no loss. Then one has to learn Krishna consciousness. Then he has to learn what is the responsibility of that ashram. So for that, he will have to hear from another responsible householder who is spiritually fixed up. He can study the Bhagavatam. And for example, in this canto itself, there's a chapter called Ideal Family Life. So he can study that chapter and understand what are the responsibilities of that particular ashram and of his human form of life like this. But we should know that the messages of the Bhagavatam are renounced messages, certainly. And they're meant for everyone. In some ways, you can say they're meant especially for those in the householder life. And the reason why the messages of the Bhagavatam seem may appear heavy when discussing household or life is because that's the general tendency. So you have the other, we might call the more positive messages about how you can engage everything in Christian service as a householder and so on. You get like one or two of those in the Bhagavatam, you know, two or three, maybe, in the whole 12 cantos. But a lot, the vast majority of the discussion is very grave. Why is it very? Because that's the tendency of conditioned life. So we're conditioned souls, so that means we're naturally moving in that direction due to inertia from beginningless ignorance. That's why that message is so strong. So then it's not really a strong message, or you can say it's a strong message given as a protection for those who are serious about spiritual life. Be careful. You're going to make this sort of decision. This is the general tendency of souls who move in that direction. So these are the things that you have to do in order to avoid victimization. And one of the things you have to do to avoid victimization is get a realistic picture of what it is. That's part of it. You have to get a realistic picture of what it is. Otherwise, conditioned life means romanticizing about it. When you don't have it, you're thinking, I'll fall in love, and we'll have so much respect for each other, and we'll love each other deeply, and nah. It's not like that. So you need a realistic picture of what it's going to be, and what is the responsibilities. Just like in the West, which is practically the whole world now, they get into what they call love marriages. You know, I love you. And as quickly as they fall in love, they fall out of love. Because it's not love, it's infatuation. The first period of a relationship is just infatuation. And then what happens is that people's personalities start coming out. And then you were like, oh my God, you're a person? This is a shock, you know, like that. And then you have to deal with their personality. And you have to deal with responsibility then. A responsibility that you may not have been prepared for, you weren't expecting, etc. So the first, one of the ideas of before entering the household situation is to get a realistic picture of what it is, or what it generally tends to be when you're conditioned. And that's what the Bhagavatam is describing. So naturally you'll hear the heavy messages. Those heavy messages are meant to encourage a life of responsibility. It's not meant to say, don't enter the Grihastha ashram. Although in the next purport, I think Prabhupada would say that is best if possible. But generally it's not possible. So that means since anyway you're going to be moving in that direction, you got to hear about what it is so that you will move in that direction responsibly. So there's nothing really heavy about the messages. It's really compassion. You know, this is this can be a type of prajalpa that says that this is heavy as a means of just dismissing the message. You know, like sometimes you may hear a speaker who seems to be speaking very harshly or heavily and so on. Perhaps it even is harsh sometimes. Perhaps the manner of the speaker is harsh and so on. So that may be to his discredit, but you have to see, is the message what he's saying realistic? Is it true? That requires intelligence and not just the emotional response. That was too heavy. That can be a type of prajalpa that causes you to dismiss the seriousness of what is being discussed. Like this, so I say that whatever we spoke today was actually quite gentle and not at all heavy. And even if it was heavy in someone's ears, it was still very important to hear these sorts of things regularly. Therefore, if anyone's regularly reading the Bhagavatam, they wouldn't be surprised by these types of messages. Another reason why devotees find these messages heavy is because they don't regularly hear the Bhagavatam. And therefore, all out of the blue, it seems like a thunderbolt out of the blue that someone's saying these things, you know. Householder life is a blind well in which you fall into and die. Then it's like, so disrespectful, you know. But if they're regularly reading the Bhagavatam, they're like, yeah, that's Prahlad Maharaj. You understand? They would be very familiar with those messages. So it's really a type of protection. You know, most of us will have to enter into the householder life. So now how can we do that responsibly? Part of doing that responsibly is to hear the renounced messages. That's part of the formula for having a successful householder life. Otherwise, one gets bewildered. That's reality. It's very bewildering. I was in Vrindavan by myself. I was living by myself for about 3 or 4 months. And so that meant taking up, I had like a little place. It was very small. And I thought I'll just live like I'm living in the Brahmacharya ashram and be like practically the same. But then I had to cook for myself. So that was something I wasn't used to ever doing my whole life. So I had to cook for myself, which meant I had to go buy boga regularly. So that was, okay, I said, okay, that's not too bad. Then I had to clean up. Like after cooking, you have to clean, right? Otherwise, or you will leave it for the next day, but then when you eat and cook, you got to clean. So then I had to clean, and I had to clean the bathroom regularly because it was in India, everything gets dirty really fast. And then there was clothes to wash. All of a sudden, it was just like these small little duties kept creeping up on me. Small, small little duties. And then it was taking away from a lot of other time because I wasn't doing it very responsibly also. I would like wait to the absolute last minute before I would have to do it. Then I had a realization. I was like, wow, when grihasas say they don't have time, they're really telling the truth. They don't have time. Of course, it's not that that's inherent. Perhaps like me, they're being a little irresponsible and therefore things get piled up. Or in a modern situation, many times grihasas get a situation where they're working like many, many hours, 10 plus hours for a job, you know, 2 to 4 hours travel. When you're working like that, when you get home, you're not thinking about, let's hear the Bhagavatam. You're thinking about, where's dinner and where's the television set or something like that. You know, you want to get a break. So, therefore, the heavy messages of the Bhagavatam. It's an act of compassion so that we can accept such responsibility. Responsibility, responsibly. That's my understanding of that sort of idea. Anything else anyone wants to ask? Should we go? Yeah, Acharya. And I'll end there for the day. I could go on longer. We could just do some reading. Well.
Thanks, Ru. You mentioned that the general tendency is towards household resistance. This is the antithesis, in one sense, of the spiritual progress, something like that. My question is, even in today's society, though, people aren't even doing household life. We see the majority of the population, they get married and then they get divorced and they do something else. And then, so even that principle is not even operating really in Kali Yuga.
No, it's operating in a just perhaps a very distorted way. Household life, you know, Griha Medhi life, perhaps if we want to make a fair distinction. Griha Medhi life, you know, they're getting girlfriend, boyfriend, doing sex life. When we hear about Griha Medhi life in the Bhagavatam, we hear that it's centered around sex life. And so that's what's going on, a life centered around sexual enjoyment. Only reason it's a little bit different is because people, they in the past, they was, let's say in Vedic culture, it would be centered around sexual enjoyment, but according to the Vedas. So they will follow Vedic things. Although they're after material enjoyment, they will follow Vedic principles, but now they don't follow Vedic principles. That's the only difference. But otherwise, in terms of consciousness, the core consciousness is actually exactly the same. A life centered around enjoyment, particularly enjoyment of sex life. So in the core, it is actually the same thing going on. But the only difference is now a life of impiety versus then a life of piety centered around sexual enjoyment. Like that. That's my understanding. Yeah, Rafiq.
I went to the Social Security office yesterday, and I saw there was, I had to get a replacement card, and I saw that there was this sign on the television, and the services they offered, it said marriage/divorce, so I thought that was pretty messed up, but anyway, about householder life, and so should the householders be doing more than the brahmacharis and the ashram?
In some ways, yeah, householder life is, a real householder is more elevated generally than a brahmachari, actually. At least in terms of, not in speaking in terms of devotion per se. Devotion is independent, so no one has a monopoly on that. But in terms of Vedic culture, the progression of Vedic culture from brahmachari to householder life, a householder would be generally more exalted than a brahmacharya, more realized, more self-controlled, etc. He was actually, that's considered a progression actually, right? It's progressing from the brahmacharya to grihasa to vanaprastha sannyas. This is a progression. So minus bhakti, because any bhakti can manifest in anyone, they're the most exalted from whatever position they're standing. Then in traditional Vedic culture, a householder would be more exalted, more mature, more realized in the brahmachari, as he would necessarily have to be because in Grihastha life, there's just so much more responsibility than in Brahmacharya life. Brahmacharya life, his main responsibility is service to the guru. He will actually live with the guru. And his main responsibility was to the guru. We'll hear this coming up in just a few purports, Prabhupada speaking a little bit about it. You know, before he would study the Vedas, he would offer obeisances to the guru and then go study. He would go out and beg on behalf of the guru. And whatever was brought, whatever was gained from begging, all of it was given to the guru. Unless the guru called you for eating, you wouldn't eat. So his duties were very simple. It all more or less centered around the guru and service to the guru. Whereas in Grihastha Ashram, responsibilities expand, beginning with the wife, and then children come. And then the Grihasthas also have a responsibility to the other four, the other three ashrams. Because they're the only ones really making money or having much facility, so they provide for the other ashrams also. So there was a lot of responsibility there in the life of a Grihastha. Therefore, they were necessarily more mature, more realized, more exalted than the Brahmachari. So, and like in our family, to become a householder is like considered like a fall down. Whereas in traditional Vedic culture, it was considered a progression. It's like now if one of our Brahmacharis, you know, suddenly puts on white, everyone's like, I knew that, you know, I had some. You know, they started whispering, and then they come up to you and say, so what happened? You know, many times, Brahmacharis, we do like this. You can see it. And our Brahmacharis, especially if we knew each other, and then we, you know, you go back, you go to a festival 1 week and they got on saffron, and you go to another festival 2 weeks later, they got on white. And the rest of us are like, oh! And then we like call them over in the corner and it's like, so what happened? You know, and we see if we could save them. And that's because of the kind of culture that was kind of set up from the very beginning in ISKCON. So the sort of ethos just carried over into the next generations. So that to be a householder, it was considered a fall down. But actually, practically speaking, even now, it's usually a more realized person. Even if he's not deeply immersed in devotion and so on, you know, FYI, most of our brahmacharis aren't either. And when a person goes from living like, let's say, practically living like a parasite, then when he enters the household life, he's forced to accept responsibility now. Now he has to take care of himself practically. He may be there with a spouse he has to take care of. So even now, in certain ways, it's a progression. Anyway, you could argue the other way, and I would probably be convinced both ways. But even now, in a certain sense, it's really a progression. So traditionally, household life is meant for very responsible people, actually. I know one reason I personally didn't want to enter the house. My spiritual master told me, like 3 or 4 years ago, he first said this is not an instruction. So I was relieved because I didn't know what he was going to say. So I was relieved to hear it wasn't an instruction because I was scared what was going to come after that. But he had mentioned that if I wanted to get married, then I should get married because at that time, all the men that I had joined with, all of them were getting married, and they were getting married in sort of funny ways. They were having programs, yoga programs, and so on. They were hooking up with the girls in their programs and getting married. So then that time, Maharaj told me that these girls were devotees also, in many cases. So Maharaj told me, if you want to get married, then, you know, you should get married. Don't think I want you to remain as a brahmachari. So I told my spiritual master at the time, I said, no, Maharaj, I don't want to ruin my human form of life. So he looked taken aback when I said that. And I said, no, let me explain. I said, I don't think that Grihastha Ashram is inherently a license, or not a license, but a contract to ruining your human form of life. But I said, but me in the Grihastha Ashram is not going to work out. Because the level of responsibility is something that I'm not ready for. In other words, I had a realistic picture of the type of responsibility Grihastha Ashram entails, and I wasn't ready for that level of responsibility, and therefore I don't want to make that sort of choice. And also because I'm satisfied the way I am now, just, you know, living, you know, little spaces they're given is fine, you know, some prasad is provided, bhagavatam is there, a little association with other men, and sex life is not so heavy, it's always heavy. But more or less, I could be happy in this situation. So there is no incumbent need to make that transition as such. And also seeing the responsibility, I knew I couldn't handle that level of responsibility if I wanted to do it right. So then Mars was like, all right, no problem like that. So real Grihastha is a life of a very responsible life. And a real Grihastha is actually a very exalted person. And when you read the Bhagavatam, you'll see that like that's what a Grihastha is. It's very exalted. Just like our Grihastha is here in the temple, actually. The ones who serve around the temple particularly. I don't know others so well, but the ones who live around the temple, just see how they live. It's not ordinary thing, actually. In fact, most of the brahmacharis that have passed through here on traveling Sankirtan and so on, they see how our Grihasthas are proudly doing everything. Practically, they do everything. That's killer, you know. The mothers, they're taking care of all the deity services and the prabhus in the morning. And the prabhus go out for working, and the mothers, they're cooking. They're doing so many other services. So that's not a very ordinary thing, actually. You won't see this. Like, I've been different places around the world. Now, trust me, you don't see this practically anywhere. And we have some, like, exalted Grihasthas even living around us. So sometimes when you hear these messages in the Bhagavatam, you might get confused because you're just looking at them. And you're thinking, no, this is not accurate, you know, because we're actually looking at exalted Grihasthas living around us. So then you may get a lack of clarity about what actually generally happens. But if you move around planet Earth a little bit, then you'll get a pretty clear picture of what actually generally goes on. I'll leave it at that. I was going to say something else, but I have to be a little careful. So just in case someone happens to bother to watch the whole class, I don't offend anyone. But if you move around a little bit, even if you move around Chicago a little bit, you can see what is the general tendency of householder life. Privately speaking, because of the Kishori, Gornitai, Jagannabhadi, Subhadra, the Grihasthas are so elevated because they are maintaining the service to them. That the service to Kishori is their everything. So because of that, they remain totally elevated. Otherwise, generally, under coupon. Or just like you think you're going to run and, you know, like in the movie, you jump for your love. So he's going to do something really dramatic and his love is standing on this side and he's going to run over and jump. The general tendency is like that. You have to be, you know, you need the mercy of the Lord. So our Grihasthas are extraordinary because they've taken the mercy of the Lord very seriously, and they do everything. But that is not something you generally see. I also was quite confused about these heavy messages. I'm like, because I'm looking at the Grihasthas here, but then later on you move around, you see what is the real situation. All right, any final things, final thoughts, concerns? Acharya wants to say something.
Another consideration is properly exiting the Grihastha ashram at the right time. That even if it is going well, you know, according to the Vedic system, one would get married early so they can do their family responsibility and have that done so that they can leave. So that's just another aspect that our movement really seems to be struggling with. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, yeah, it has something to do with our educational system. Because, first of all, brahmacharya tradition would start from a very young age. So people are getting purified from a very young age, and things are starting to become self-evident, probably by their teens, the type of psychology, probably the type of direction they need to move. The gurus can see that and so on. But nowadays, people are coming when they're 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, like this, and they've probably done everything. I mean, we heard on the camping trip, the type of stuff that was going on in most of our lives before coming to Christian consciousness, and it wasn't pretty. And then, so they have a killer load of misconceptions and so on gained from their 18, you know, plus years. And then they come to Christian consciousness, and we have to train them and educate them. Now, traditionally, after, you know, 20, maybe let's say up to 25, then you have to make the decision. Now people are coming, and, you know, they have to relearn practically everything. Probably whatever they've learned up until that point is more or less completely useless. More or less. probably more than less, useless. And so there's like a whole re-educational system has to be implanted, and perhaps we don't always get enough time, or we want more time for that, so we take more time. So they end up being like 30, 35, and then at that time they think I have to get married, or maybe even more, longer. So it would have to be, just like here, properly entering the Brahmacharya ashram depends on proper education during Brahmacharya. It would have to speak to our educationals, how are we going to train devotees in the future? Given the fact that many may actually have to make that transition, what is the way we're going to educate them so that they can make that transition responsibly? And ISKCON, the way we've normally done it in the past is just to emphasize renunciation, hardcore in Brahmacharya ashram, you know, and then every chance we get, we just take a blow, a swing at the Grihastha ashram. Just like you hear me joke many times when something doesn't work out in Grihastha ashram or something for a particular person, you'll hear me joke, take note of that. You know, so this is our sort of quote-unquote training. But it may speak to how we may need to change some of our pedagogy, understanding that people will have to make that transition at a certain point so that they can do it responsibly. I also, just as an aside though, I like to mention that bhakti is not dependent on the successful application of Varnashram Dharma in any way. Successful application of bhakti is not dependent upon successful following of religious principles per se. In other words, if someone decides to get married at 50, that doesn't mean he can't achieve the goal of life, theoretically. Although it may cause a sort of absorption in family affairs and so on, but it may not also. He may just decide that I need a little bit more emotional, whatever, and he decides to make the decision. That doesn't mean he can't be successful in devotion because he decides to make that choice at a late age. Ultimately we have to do what we... The moral compass for a devotee is what is favorable for Shravanam Kirtanam, what is favorable for achieving bhakti, and what is unfavorable. Of course, one may ideally do that in relationship to various guides in their life, those they have faith in to guide their bhajan in a particular way. But that is a moral compass for a devotee. So sometimes it may be decided, it may be late, that staying, getting in that situation is favorable. Sometimes it may be deemed favorable to just stay in that situation. Although we should know that this isn't per se religious principle, and the reason religious principles are given is to assist the successful performance of bhakti, so just negligence of them may not be a good idea. But it doesn't mean that inherently one is not going to make advancement. Although we do practically see that devotees who choose not to leave the ashram, even when in an unfavorable situation, so on. There's like a general pattern that may be perceived, for which we can understand why the religious principles are there. But still, it is not inherently the case that the successful application of the principles of religion leads to successful application of bhakti. That is not an inherent rule. Similarly, it's not an inherent rule that the non-acceptance of religious principles leads to non-success in bhakti. That is, so I just like to make that as an aside. And I do feel that because of the bhakti moral compass, the lines do get blurred because we don't strictly follow religious principles. Like, for example, how is a sannyasi supposed to live? How is a brahmachari supposed to live, religiously speaking, according to the Vedas? You don't see that we're living like that. We adopt Yuddha Vairagya to is an extraordinary degree, how we adopt Yuddha Vairagya. And we don't really follow religious principles so much, you know, dharma concerning that particular ashram, because we say bhakti. So our application of bhakti has blurred the lines a lot in terms of how we apply the religious principles. It blurs everything. On a societal level, if we wanted to make it more clear, we would have to stick more strictly. In our training, we would have to stick more strictly to the parameters of religion. But I doubt that's going to happen. So therefore, you have the bhakti moral compass and some very blurred religious principles going on within the society. That's what's happening now. And it can be very irritating what to do. That's the situation. That's my understanding. Bhakti has blurred our application of religious principles. Why? Because the successful performance of bhakti is not dependent upon religious principles. And so the lines get a little blurred. What to do? Yeah, it's all right. I'll take your last question. It's 8:30.
This is a question online from Himanshu. He said he was talking to a certain Harinam leader and who told him that he sees devotees regularly leaving the Harinam ashram after a couple of years. So Himanshu's question is, what kind of training do we give to people so they don't leave after practicing for just a few years due to being overcome by previous samskaras from wasting their life?
I mean, the main responsibility of any preacher in the Krishna consciousness movement is to give people taste for hearing about Krishna and taste for chanting Krishna's names. That is the main duty of a Mandyam Adhikari. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says the main duty of a Mandyam Adhikari is to assist people in chanting the pure holy name of Krishna. So Prabhupada writes in the fifth chapter of the first canto that pure devotional sangha is as infectious in a good way as infectious diseases. So I like to say, do we have the infection? Have you caught the infection? And if you haven't caught the infection, how can you give it, the infection, to others? You understand? Just like, anyway, tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is very contagious. All you have to do is, and someone else can get it. So the more you're infected with the disease, if you will, of Krishna consciousness, disease from the material perspective at least, the more you're able to give that infection to others. So how do we keep people from leaving the ashram? Well, we have to first take the responsibility to ourselves of really catching up the infection and augmenting the infection, taste for Krishna consciousness. Then when training others, we have to give that infection to them so that even if they leave the ashram per se, they won't leave Krishna consciousness, which also happens quite a bit. Turnover rate is high. That's my understanding. Otherwise, there is no rule. People are overwhelmed by their previous samskaras. How do we hope to overcome that? The only principle in overcoming that is sadhu sangha. So in that regard, you can see Baladeva Vibhushana's commentary to chapter 3, verse 33 of Bhagavad Gita, where this very question and answer is given. If you see 333 Bhagavad Gita, Baladeva Vibhushana's commentary. We'll end there. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.